Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's African American Studies program. Speaking is Dr. Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University. Dr. Joseph's lecture is titled, Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. We begin with an introduction by Jean Jarrett, Acting Director of African American Studies at Boston University.
I'd like to introduce Peniel Joseph, who is a professor of history at Tufts, and he's the author of the award-winning Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America. And he's also the author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, as well as the editor of the Black Power Movement, Rethinking the Civil Rights Black Power Era. And he's also the editor of Neighborhood Rebels, Black Power at the Local Level. Dr. Joseph is founder of a growing subfield in American history and Africana studies that he has characterized as Black Power Studies, which is actively rewriting post-war American and African-American history, as well as related interdisciplinary fields of Africana studies, law and society, sociology, political science, women and ethnic studies, philosophy, anthropology, literary studies, and American studies, to name a few. And I also would like to add that he's just published an essay that appeared in Chronicle of Higher Education, which is superb, and I really would hope that you get a chance to investigate his work. He's a frequent national commentator on issues of race, democracy, and civil rights, who appears on C-SPAN's Book TV, NPR, and PBS's NewsHour. During the 2008 Democratic and Republican National Conventions, Professor Joseph provided historical commentary for the PBS NewsHour. He's the recipient of fellowship from Harvard University's Charles Warren Center, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the Ford Foundation. His essays have appeared in the Journal of American History, the Chronicle Review, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Book Forum, and the American Historical Review. He lives in Somerville, Massachusetts. So with great pleasure, I introduce Peniel Joseph.
Thank you for having me, especially to Professor Garrett, Dr. Garrett, for inviting me here. I'm fighting through a cold. I've been on the road much of 2010, doing both book talks, but also work around Haitian relief as well. I've got both of my parents were from Haiti, and I was born in New York City, and fortunately, my family in Port-au-Prince is fine, but they're without homes and without shelters. So it's been a double duty of trying to both get resources to family back home, back in Haiti, and also trying to help with the overall relief effort. And that's really one of the things I write about in this op-ed. I talk about Haitian history and the United States, because one of the things that, when we look at CNN and some of the coverage, they kept talking about Haiti was the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, but never the first really black republic, and never the fact that, you know, Haiti's existence is something that provides huge inspiration to African Americans during the antebellum period, and people like Frederick Douglass and different abolitionists really cite Haiti, and they cite Toussaint Louverture as this heroic figure and this self-made man in the 19th century. And conversely, how people like Thomas Jefferson really found the whole idea of a black republic repugnant and did everything they could to undermine Haiti's progress and success. And that's a lost history. In the 20th century, the United States occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934 is rarely mentioned. And that occupation came with a lot of rape and a lot of violence and a lot of distortion of the republic. So that's a part of Haiti's history that is rarely talked about, and I wanted to shed some light on that. Skip Gates has a great op-ed too in The Root on Haiti and Thomas Jefferson and the history, which is an important read. I'm going to read a little bit from this new book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. And basically, the reason why I wrote this book was really to try to make our national civil rights history harder and more complicated.
and to really, within the context of talking about our national civil rights history, during the 2008 election, people were talking about Barack Obama and they talked about Martin Luther King Jr. And I always thought they didn't give justice to King. The King they presented was a King who was a dreamer, who was somebody who was not combative, who didn't really have a robust critique of American democracy. And they really gave no mention of people like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, unless they were really trying to criticize both Barack and Michelle Obama. So, for instance, one conservative commentator said that Michelle Obama, in terms of her combativeness, was like Stokely Carmichael in a dress, right? And so what I tried to do in this book and what I try to do throughout this work is to really look at the way in which black power radicalism has transformed American democracy in the post-war period. And I do this through both Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X, but other figures, William Worthy, Lorraine Hansberry. And then finally, look at how the longest essay in the book looks at Barack Obama and Obama's vision of American democracy, but the way in which Obama is rooted in legacies of both civil rights and black power, whether or not he understands that or he wants to acknowledge that is not the point. The point is that he really is rooted in both of those legacies in a number of different ways, and it's important for us to recognize that. Okay, so I'm going to read. At times I'm going to go off script as well, and bear with me because I'm fighting this this cold. Gene said that it was going to be exciting, and I'm usually more animated than this. From Malcolm X's vivid denunciations of racism outside of Harlem's gritty storefronts to Stokely Carmichael's dramatic call for black power in Mississippi, radical black political activists during the civil rights and black power era openly questioned America's capacity to extend full citizenship to African Americans. However, Malcolm's and Carmichael's confrontational styles and combative words have obscured their pivotal roles in transforming American democracy. And here I really want to stress this point. When I think about the Black Power movement, we usually think about Black Power as a movement of gun-toting black militants, most explicitly the Black Panthers, who practice politics without portfolio and drag down a more promising movement for social justice, in this case, the civil rights movement. In fact, when we think about Black Power is coming out of the same historical context as the civil rights period. So we can think about civil rights and Black Power as really two branches on the same historical family tree that at times intertwine. At times, they diverge as well in very combative ways, but at times we have organizations and activists who really straddle both movements. And when we think about Black Power and its attempts to transform democracy, we usually look at Malcolm X as only the violent counterpoint to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And even the famous book by James Cone sort of amplifies that, Malcolm and Martin and American Dream or American Nightmare. When we look at the way in which Malcolm was a political leader and political activist, especially between 1952 and 1965 when he's released from prison, we really see something much different. We see somebody who starts out in Philadelphia and then Harlem as a local organizer who actually tries to turn a sectarian group, the Nation of Islam, into a secular and more cosmopolitan group. And along the way, he's going to really be the leader of a local, then regional, and then national movement for black power in places like New York City, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles. And so even before the 1959 Newsbeat documentary by Mike Wallace, The Hate That Hate Produced, in the summer of 1959, when, by the way, Malcolm was on his first tour of Africa, because Malcolm tours Africa three times between 1959 and 64, but we only talk about 1964. And the Spike Lee movie, the 1992 Spike Lee movie, Malcolm X, only looks at the 1964 trips as well, and really only one of those trips. It's important to note that Malcolm goes to Africa in 1959 because way before he He's kicked out of the Nation of Islam in 1964. Malcolm realizes that there's white Muslims. He realizes that the racial cosmology of the Nation of Islam is way off base. The reason why he stays in the group is that people often stay in political parties even though they disagree with aspects of those political organizations, right? So people, Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Socialists, you can stay, or even if you're a religious person and you're in a denomination that you disagree with in terms of gay marriage or whatever, do you leave the organization or do you stay in it? So Malcolm chose to stay at least up until 1964. Hailed as bold oracles of racial militancy, Carmichael and Malcolm's defiant identification with underdogs, ranging from prisoners to sharecroppers, made them particularly attuned to democracy's shortcomings and jagged edges. The image of Malcolm, his finger stabbing the air to make a point about racial oppression in America, remains searing. Likewise, the vision of Carmichael, eyes blazing on a humid Mississippi evening as he asserted that only raw political power could definitively protect the lives of African Americans living in the South, persist in our cultural history. Like ancient museum artifacts, these images offer a powerful, if flattened, image of the past. But the popular memory of Malcolm and Carmichael remains misunderstood, focused as it is more on their fiery rhetorical style than the substantive meaning behind their words. Despite their volatile images, Malcolm and Carmichael play crucial roles in America's extraordinary journey from black power to Barack Obama. Since the nation's inception, black Americans have been among the most vocal, eloquent, and long-standing proponents of American democracy. Yet due to their status as chattel slavery until 1865 and their subsequent legal disenfranchisement during Jim Crow, African Americans' relationship to democracy remains star-crossed. In spite of these obstacles, however, black political leaders have held steadfast to a belief in the redemptive values of citizenship in pursuit of larger goals of racial, political, and economic equality. This has remained true from Frederick Douglass's famous 1852 speech extolling the paradoxical nature of 4th of July celebrations in a nation scarred by slavery, to Ida B. Wells' passionate anti-lynching crusade, and to W.E.B. Du Bois' groundbreaking work as a founder of the NAACP. When we think about democracy in black Americans, I think that one of the most understudied aspect of the black freedom struggle is the fact that at its core, it's a movement for radical democracy. And when we think about the black power movement, the black power movement really ratchets up the rhetoric of the civil rights era and calls for a bold political, social, cultural, economic transformation of existing democratic institutions and also the creation of new ones. It's no coincidence that when we think about the Black Panthers, alongside of the Panthers' Marxist-Leninist rhetoric and the call for a socialist revolution is a 10-point program that specifically quotes from the Declaration of Independence. So even as the Panthers are calling for a socialist revolution, they're at the same time using the rhetoric of democracy and the tenets found in some of the sacred texts of this republic to fashion an imagination or an imagery of political and social transformation that's rooted in radical democracy. When we think about the years 1954 to 1965, these are the years that I call the heroic period of the civil rights movement. And what I mean by heroic period of the civil rights movement is that during this period, we have a newsreel-like imagery of all these events and demonstrations and protests. It starts May 17, 1954, with the Brown desegregation court decision. It continues into the 1955-56 13-month bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, that features really grassroots organizers like E.D. Nixon and Rosa Parks, but propels a 26-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. into the national spotlight. The lynching of Emmett Till in 1955 is crucial here. Till is lynched on August 28, 1955, and he's a 14-year-old black boy from Chicago who's on vacation in Tallahatchie County in Mississippi, and he's going to be lynched for saying bye baby to the wife of a white shop owner. And what's important about that is that Till's body is going to be found in the Tallahatchie River with a 125-pound cotton gin fan belt tied around his neck. And his mother is going to allow his body to be viewed in an open casket. And Jet Magazine, which is the African-American working-class magazine of the post-war period, which is still being published today, and Jet is the working-class magazine, and Ebony is for the black bourgeoisie. So in my house, we had Jet and Ebony. So I was straddling both fences right there. When we think about Emmett Till's assassination really impacts a whole generation of African Americans, from Stokely Carmichael, who's in the Morris Park section of the Bronx when he finds out about Emmett Till, to the novelist John Edgar Wideman. There's going to be stories of African Americans who are really baby boomers who are coming of age and they're 13, 14 years old, and they find out about Emmett Till, both in the North, the South, all over. 1957 is the Little Rock crisis. 1960, four black students at North Carolina A&T who ignite the direct action phase of the civil rights movement, which is the sit-in movement. By April of 1960 in Raleigh, we see the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. In 1962, Mississippi undergoes 3 days of rioting in Oxford at the prospect of enrolling an African-American student, James Meredith. 1963 is very, very well remembered as both the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, but also the year where the city of Birmingham, Alabama, is on fire. And we usually think about King and the letter from a Birmingham jail, where King argues that the civil rights movement can't wait because clergy and different civic organizations are asking King to wait. And he says that the desegregation movement and campaign cannot wait because waiting will mean a defamation and a distortion of American democracy. We often forget that same spring and summer, Malcolm X is really confronting the Birmingham crisis from Washington, D.C. as a militant statesman and consistently criticizing President Kennedy as a president who's more concerned with political expediency than he is with the lives of young black teenagers and young black women and men in Birmingham. And Malcolm's right, empirically. He's right. Kennedy was more concerned about political expediency than he was about the lives of black people in the spring and summer of 1963, no matter what we say about his legacy belatedly. In 1963 as well is the August 28th March on Washington. And when we think about that March on Washington, we usually just remember the end of King's I Have a Dream speech. It's really a march for jobs and justice. 250,000 people gather in Washington, D.C. to really signal a clarion call for not just civil rights, but for human rights. King talks about reparations in that I Have a Dream speech. He talks about the fact that when we think about the great reservoirs of American democracy, sometimes he alludes to it as the great wells of American democracy, that blacks have come to the bank of American democracy with a note, with a promissory note. And they refuse to believe that the bank of justice is bankrupt. And that promissory note is about more than civil rights. It's about more than voting rights. It's about everything from economic justice and ending poverty to health care to decent housing. So when we think about this heroic period of the civil rights movement. And of course, a few weeks later, on September 16th, after the March on Washington, four black girls in Birmingham, Alabama, are killed at the 16th Street Baptist Church, which was Condoleezza Rice's church, by the way. It was a very upper middle class Baptist church, which is one of the reasons why the terrorists targeted that church. So Malcolm X, in the aftermath of that, is going to call the March on Washington a farce on Washington and talk about the murder of these four little black girls. 1964, we see the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and in 1965, on August 6th, the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which is really culminating out of Bloody Sunday and the marches in Selma in March of 1965. And that's our portrait of the heroic period of the civil rights movement. Now, when we think about the Black Power period, we look at Black Power as something that signals the demise of that heroic period of the civil rights movement. We look at Black Power as really originating in the racial uprising, what critics called riots and what proponents called rebellions, maybe more objective people call civil disorders, in Watts. From August 11th to August 18th, there's going to be a week long of racial upheaval in the Watts section of Los Angeles. And what's interesting about that is that, in a way, even though these civil disorders started in 1963 in Birmingham and are going to continue up into the late 60s, between 64 and 68, there's going to be over 350 civil disturbances in over 250 American cities. Black power, the way in which it's popularly imagined, is rooted in the racial rioting and the racial violence of the period, right? By 1966, Stokely Carmichael becomes chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and SNCC becomes a proponent of Black Power. By June 16, 1966, in Greenwood, Mississippi, during the Meredith March, Stokely Carmichael unleashes the term Black Power, right? By October of 1966, UEP Newton and Bobby Seale, two part-time college students, found the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which is coming out of Stokely Carmichael and SNCC's activism in Lowndes County, Alabama, right? The original Black Panther Party is coming out of Lowndes. When we think about Black Power, then, Black Power becomes the civil rights movement's doppelganger. It becomes its evil twin. And one of the things that I argue in this book is that when we think about the Black Power movement, civil rights and Black Power are not mutually exclusive. Malcolm X is going to have a sustained critique of American democracy between 1952 and 1965, and really be one of the most strident proponents of trying to transform the civil rights movement into a global human rights movement. And this is even before the break from the Nation of Islam. And it's important to say this because we tend to try to characterize Malcolm as somebody who only comes to his senses once he leaves the Nation of Islam. You know, he's this brilliant man who's misguided by the Nation of Islam, and it's only once he's kicked out of the Nation of Islam that he comes to his senses. He realizes whites and blacks can be brothers and sisters, and you know they could live happily ever after. And boy, gee whiz, Malcolm is gunned down before he has a chance to live up to his promise. Historically, this is not accurate. When we think about Malcolm X, especially between the time he becomes the head of Muslim Mosque Number 7 in Harlem on West 116th Street in 1954, up until his assassination on February 21st, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights, Malcolm is consistently trying to confront democracy's jagged edges. Malcolm is consistently criticizing civil rights activism that doesn't step up to the level of realizing that the United States needs an actual political revolution if true citizenship is to be achieved by African Americans. And by citizenship, again, we mean beyond just voting rights, beyond civil rights acts, so beyond a legalistic or a legislative framework for citizenship. I want to talk about Stokely Carmichael for a moment and then get into Barack Obama. Stokely Carmichael, who I'm working on a biography of Stokely Carmichael right now, is really one of the most important figures of the post-war period. And Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture by 1979, is born on June 29th, 1941, in Port of Spain, Trinidad. He emigrates to the United States 2 weeks before his 11th birthday in 1952 in the Morris Park section of the Bronx. Carmichael is one of the few black students who tests into Bronx Science High School in 1956, one of the best public schools in New York City. So he's going to be about one of seven African Americans in a predominantly Jewish school who graduates in 1960. Carmichael is an activist from the word go. He's involved in political activism as a teenager in New York City. Bronx Science is a font of left-wing activism. So Carmichael imbibes two traditions of black activism. One is coming from Harlem and 125th Street, where he goes to get a haircut every 2 weeks with his father, Adolf. Another is coming out of a stream of social democratic, but also Marxist-Leninism and CP, Communist Party of the United States of America activism. One of his best friends is Gene Dennis, who's the son of one of the leading figures in the CP. What's interesting for us is that Carmichael goes to Howard University in 1960, and he becomes part of the Nonviolent Action Group, which is SNCC's affiliate at Howard. So SNCC really starts as a loose confederation of different campus-based organizations. They're going to have a headquarters in Atlanta, but really there's going to be different headquarters, some in Nashville, some at Howard University, and some at different universities all across the country. When we think about Stokely Carmichael, Carmichael is arrested in 1961 as a freedom rider on June 8th, riding in the 17th group of freedom riders who are trying to challenge segregation along interstate travel in the South. And when we think about Carmichael in that first arrest, he's going to spend 49 days in Mississippi's worst prison farm in 1961. And this is at 19 years old. He's going to celebrate his 20th birthday in prison. So between 1961 and 1966, Stokely Carmichael is arrested 27 times for civil rights activism. And so what's extraordinary for me is that when we think about Stokely Carmichael, before he unleashes this term black power, he's one of the few Americans of any color who actually bleeds for democracy domestically, okay? Carmichael is in Cambridge, Maryland, in Washington, D.C., in the Mississippi Delta, in Lowndes County, Alabama, undergoing physical violence, undergoing wrongful and illegal arrests, by the way, because none of these arrests are legal. We want to point that out. He's undergoing a hugely arduous journey that really most of us could not imagine. And I really like to stress this point because we live in a time, 2010, where many people claim to have marched with Dr. King and claim to have participated in this era, and they're not telling us the truth. Okay, and I'll repeat that. Many people claim to have marched with Dr. King. They claim to have been on the right side of history, but they're not telling us the truth because during the 1960s, civil rights was not popular. During the 1950s, civil rights was not popular. 50 and 60 years later, we see this as a moral and political good. At the time, it was not popular. Okay? When we think about Stokely Carmichael, Carmichael becomes very, very important to us because by the time he unleashes this phrase, black power, in 1966, he's arguing that only through black power can small d democracy be achieved in the United States. And he writes about this very eloquently. There's a piece in the New Republic, January 8th, 1966, where he talks about democracy's best face is etched in the visages of black sharecroppers in Lowndes County, Alabama. So for Stokely Carmichael, democracy is not about getting black senators and governors. It's about allowing poor black people. And remember, these are black people who are living in the black belt of Alabama and Mississippi, who are never going to have birth certificates or certificates of death, some of whom have never seen money. And I need to explain that. They've never seen American currency because they're on plantations where they don't receive money and they exchange goods and services for something called script. So they're living a kind of feudal existence, right, since America's 19th and 18th century. So for them, emancipation did not bring about an entirely new world. And this is where Stokely Carmichael tries to create and organize local grassroots movements for social, political, economic power in the Deep South. Because remember, in 1966, there is no small d democracy in the South. Sometimes people may tell you that during the 1960s and 50s and before the end of Jim Crow that there was second-class citizenship for African Americans. I would argue that they're wrong. There is no classes, there are no classes of citizenship in a democracy. You're either a citizen or you're not. When we think about Carmichael and Black Power, Carmichael defines Black Power as a movement for social, economic, cultural, and political self-determination. Right? It's not a movement that's anti-white. It's not a movement that's even calling for racial separatism. In Carmichael's words, it's a movement that's going to allow blacks to decide their own political, social, and cultural future at the local, regional, national, and global level. I'm going to wrap this up by talking about Barack Obama. When we think about Barack Obama, 2008 was an extraordinary watershed year in American history. The election of the first African-American president really sparked a lot of grandiose rhetoric about a post-racial American future and rhetoric about the end of black politics. I would argue that the election of Barack Obama really allows us to look at the evolution of black politics. And when we think about Obama, Obama is best understood within the context of the civil rights and black power period that precedes his election. And when we think about that, we have to look at the continuation of struggles for social and political justice that go beyond the 1960s. One quick note is that during the election, Barack Obama consistently used certain quotes from Dr. King, the fierce urgency of now. In our own historical context, we really marginalized Dr. King. Even as we're building a monument for him on the Washington Mall and we celebrate a national holiday, we marginalized the complete Dr. King. Dr. King talked about a world house in 1967-68. Dr. King talked about America as the biggest purveyor of violence in the late 1960s. Dr. King talked about a four-point program for education, for employment, for health care, and an end to military escalations and military adventures. Dr. King was one of the foremost critics of the Vietnam War, along with Stokely Carmichael. So when we think about Dr. King, we foreshorten Dr. King's political presence by ending in 1963 with the I Have a Dream speech. We end in 1963 because King embarks, especially starting in 1965, on a crusade for economic justice and racial justice that forces him to transform himself, in the words of one of his biographers, into a pillar of fire on behalf of social and economic justice across the United States. And by doing so, King becomes one of the most loathed figures in mainstream American media by 1967-68. The New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, in the aftermath of Dr. King's April 4th, 1967 Riverside address in New York City, when he comes out against the Vietnam War, they demonize Dr. King. And I repeat, demonize Dr. King. Even with the PhD from this university, they demonize him and say, why is he discussing issues of war and connecting that to the civil rights movement? They say that Dr. King has done his cause a disservice. And can you imagine the condescension and the racism, his cause, as if civil rights is only a black person's personal cause? It's not our entire society's cause. So that's a caveat. When we think about Obama and black power, Obama comes of age in Chicago politically in the 1980s. He comes of age in Harold Washington's Chicago. Harold Washington is elected the first black mayor of Chicago in 1983, and Washington is a black power mayor. Washington is a black power mayor who's elected with a coalition of not just civil rights advocates and liberals, but with a coalition of militants and radicals who were part and parcel of the black power period. And it's Washington's election that inspires Jesse Jackson to run a national campaign in 1984 and 1988 for president. And whatever we may think of Jesse Jackson now, and however much he has been caricaturized by the media, and the media has distorted those runs in 84 and 88 as race-based runs, as if Jesse Jackson had his fist out and was calling for black power while running for president. Jesse Jackson ran as a rainbow candidate. He ran as a candidate for the people with a message that he would be everybody's president. unfortunately, America hadn't caught up yet, right? So Jesse Jackson, when he's speaking in San Francisco at the 1984 Democratic National Convention, he is talking about the legacy of the civil rights movement. He's talking about Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman and martyrs who were killed and assassinated during the movement. He's talking about Fannie Lou Hamer. He's talking about Medgar Evers. But he's talking about this 21 years after it happened. America is not ready yet. Guess what? He's talking about a Democratic Party that refused to allow Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democrats to sit at the convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey in August of 1964. And people like Bob Moses and Stokely Carmichael were on the boardwalk protesting against that. And no less than the President of the United States is the person who is disallowing them from being sat. Right? He's talking to a party where the first time they let a black person do the keynote at the party was 1976 with Barbara Jordan. Right? So he's not talking to an expansive Democratic Party. He's not talking to an anti-racist Democratic Party. He's talking to a Democratic Party that is still held hostage to its really tragic history in terms of the politics of race. So when we think about Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88, these are nothing less than heroic campaigns to try to transform American democracy. Doesn't mean that there's no mistakes. It doesn't mean that there's no shortcomings or flaws or failures. But these aren't campaigns that should be ridiculed. These aren't campaigns that should be marginalized. And part of the infrastructure of the Jackson campaigns was to transform the Democratic Party's rules and rule makings to really get rid of the winner-take-all system. The winner-take-all system, which would have left Hillary Clinton the nominee in 2008. Without the Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88, there would have still been a winner-take-all system by the time Barack Obama ran for president, and he wouldn't have been able to still get delegates while winning congressional districts, right? So Jesse Jackson actually injects, and it's not just Jackson, it's the movement surrounding Jackson, because it's going to be a movement that within the Democratic Party primaries gets 3.5 million votes in 1984 and gets 7 million votes, about 6.7 million votes in 1988. So it's that movement that pushes the Democratic Party into a more equalitarian framework, and that allows Barack Obama to gain the nomination. Another example of Black Power and Barack Obama, though, is the way in which Obama comes of age in a Chicago that's dominated not just by Harold Washington and the Johnson family, but also Louis Farrakhan and also Jeremiah Wright. I mean, certainly he's going to break with Jeremiah Wright, but Trinity United is really the church that allows Barack Obama to really have a context for African-American culture. Right? Because he's raised in Hawaii. He's born August 4th, 1961 in Hawaii. He doesn't come mainland full time until 1979, and that's Pasadena, California. There's not a lot of black folks in Pasadena then or now. He comes to New York City in 1981, and really that's the start, but it's Chicago that really takes him into a different direction. And even in his memoir, Dreams from My Father, he talks about Malcolm X. He talks about admiration for Malcolm X's ability to recreate himself, but he also talks about the civil rights movement. And he talks about the way in which he feels that community organizing held out the promise of collective redemption. And both Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael were community organizers. I mean, even as Barack Obama, in a very pointed way, tried to connect himself to the legacy of Dr. King. Dr. King was the era's key political mobilizer, but was not a political, a grassroots political organizer. In closing, I've been talking for a while. In closing, when we think about Barack Obama, the legacy of Obama really straddles two traditions. One is the civil rights tradition, and he makes the famous speech in 2007 about the Joshua generation in Selma. He says that he's part of a generation that has been bequeathed a legacy, and he's going to continue that generation, and he's they're the Joshua generation. When we think about the Old Testament, Moses was allowed to see but not get to the Promised Land. Obviously, Dr. King's very famous last speech, April 3rd, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, he says that he's seen the Promised Land and that he may not get there with African Americans, with the black community, but they will make it. And what Obama says almost 40 years later is that he's part of the generation that's going to get a chance to see it. The less talked about aspect of Obama is really the way in which black power activism helps facilitate his rise. And when we think about black power activism, post-1965, it's black power activists who utilize the Voting Rights Act, who utilize legislation that's passed during the civil rights era in very combative ways to force the institutionalization of a black presence in a number of different institutions. Universities are probably one of the biggest examples when you think about the institutionalization of black studies programs and departments, Africana studies, cultural centers and programs all across the country. But black politics is another. And when we think about black politics and black corporate context, this is an example of black power that's much more pragmatic, much more moderate, right? They weren't part of that anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist strain, although you're going to have certain liberals like a Richard Hatcher from Gary, Indiana, a Harold Washington from Chicago, but it's still very, very important nonetheless. So I would close by saying when we think about Barack Obama, Obama is coming out of both of these strains of black political activism. Whether or not the White House is going to acknowledge this, and obviously they won't because there are political consequences to that acknowledgement, it's important for us to understand this analytically and historically. Thank you. I don't want to keep going.
The floor is open.
Thank you. I was hoping you could speak a little about the future of the Black Power movement, especially after the presidency of Barack Obama, and once it all dies down, like where is it going to go from here? And if you could just.
No, absolutely. I think both civil rights and black power continue in our times. I think the way in which we look at social movements a lot as pundits and critics is a little different from how we look at it as historians. There are certainly high points, but it doesn't mean that just because the social movement isn't experiencing one of those high points that it's completely over. So when we think about at the grassroots level, black power after the mid-1970s certainly continues. Whether it's in the academy, whether it's in black bookstores, whether it's in different cultural centers, what have you. I do think that what we're probably going to see in the aftermath of the presidency of Barack Obama, it really depends on how successful that presidency is, or at least it's perceived by. Because remember, Obama faced criticism. On August 1st, 2008, he was in St. Petersburg, Florida, and he was heckled by a group of radical black power activists with a big sign that said, "What about the black community, Obama?" And I write about that in my book, and I always thought that was very interesting because I thought they were, you know, Obama defended his civil rights record. They said he's not talking about race politics enough and racism enough. And the two groups, you know, they spoke past each other, and I actually thought they were two examples of black power right there. I thought that Obama, as the senator running for president, was a much more moderate and pragmatic example, and the young people who were part of a group called Uhuru, which is Swahili for freedom, and they're connected literally to the high point of the black power period through a person called Omali Yeshitela, who was formerly Joe Waller and was a colleague of Stokely Carmichael's and SNCC and part of a group called the Junta of Militant Organizations in the Florida area. So what I think is that it really depends. It's going to depend on how successful his presidency is perceived, but also on some levels, the continuation of a black power movement is both connected to Obama, but also it's self-perpetuating as well. It's also disconnected, meaning that even before Obama's rise, you're still going to have a continuation and evolution of that movement, but certainly it's at the grassroots level. It's not, it doesn't have the same public face as it did. At times it flashes forward. The Million Man March in 1995 is a great example. October 16th, that was called. I was there. New York Times said it was like, 400,000? I certainly felt there was a million people there, but I couldn't count that high by myself. I do think it's going to continue to go on, and I think that it really depends. When we think about Black Power now, I think it's very, very diverse and very, very heterogeneous. I mean, I think you see it at times in terms of corporate and much more conservative and pragmatic levels. I think you see it in more liberal and radical levels in terms of the academy and the black intelligentsia. I think you also see it at the grassroots level, and some of those have even Afrocentric strains of Black Power. So it just really is going to depend on where. But certainly Obama has energized a young group of African Americans who might be representative of a neoliberal civil rights and Black Power strain. And I don't mean neoliberal in a reactionary context. I mean like new. Because, for instance, based on the polling, Pew Research polls right now, African Americans are much more optimistic. And you saw in the aftermath of the election a real sense, deep sense of patriotism. And don't get me wrong, I mean, patriotism is very well ingrained in African Americans, have fought in every single war this republic has ever had, but including the antebellum period, including Revolutionary War and War of 1812 and the Civil War. But you saw it much more on display in the aftermath of his election. So certainly that group of young, and we see so many young people were trying to get into office and try to have some kind of multiracial appeal. So that's going to be one strain, because again, my argument is that Black Power is heterogeneous, meaning that some people will say there's only the Malcolm X strain of Black Power, and if you're not, you know, if you're to the right of Malcolm, that's it. And I do say that the overall thrust of the movement in the 60s and 70s was radical, but there was still a wide spectrum. So there was more conservative Black Power activists, even somebody like Floyd McKissick in Soul City, and tries to get money from Richard Nixon, to people who are even to the left of Stokely Carmichael and some of these radicals.
Professor Joseph, I'd like to thank you for a very informative and stimulating presentation.
Thank you.
In thinking about President Barack Obama and his future direction, it seems to me that he's been given a relatively brief honeymoon, that is, in terms of giving him a chance, especially since the challenges that he inherited, these global kinds of challenges are unprecedented in some ways. But there's also a pretty clear indication that he's potentially losing some of his most passionate base, mm-hmm. as well, out of impatience or a sense that there might be some sort of betrayal of some of the strongest promises. And I'm wondering, based on your analysis of what's influenced his political outlook, if there's a model back there in his past that he might be drawing on that we don't perceive, that might help us understand better his style, the Chicago context, for example. Yeah. Is that something that might explain the way in which he sees it necessary to try to work with all different mm-hmm. parts of mm-hmm. the spectrum in ways that some of us might think it's just about too extreme in trying to meet them more than halfway and so forth?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I do think that Chicago influences Obama's political style. I think, again, he's a pragmatist. I think he's a pragmatist. So I think he's trying to cover all his bases, and I think that by having somebody like Rahm Emanuel as your chief of staff, that's about trying to get things done, even though somebody like Emanuel is not necessarily popular with liberals and progressives, because he's a pragmatist as well. He's just trying to get things done. When we look at his past in terms of Chicago, I think, you know, Harold Washington's a great example of somebody who did try to appeal to the other side, even people who really disliked him. And he had to, because the mayor of Washington still needed the city council, right, to get things done. In terms of progressives and in terms of black politics, I think that he represents an interesting challenge, because he's the first African American political icon who's very, very respected in the black community, who's also president of the United States. So that's never happened before, and that's really, really difficult to sort of, how do you run against that? And I think that's presenting really unique challenges. I mean, you know, his style of, if we look at his biography, he's very pragmatic and has always been a politician. I mean, he's the first black president of the Harvard Law Review. I mean, so on some levels, I don't think people should be surprised by this governing style. At the same time, and we're going to listen to the State of the Union tonight. It probably needs to be recalibrated if he's going to serve another term, because this is the kind of he's straddling all sides, but it's this kind of political style has gotten him to the presidency. So you continue to try to use that political style, but once you're governing, it's probably going to be different than constantly campaigning, you know, so. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University. Dr. Joseph's lecture was titled Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and was presented by Boston University's African American Studies Program. Dr. Joseph was introduced by Jean Jarrett, Acting Director of African American Studies at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.